Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, welcome back. You might remember the scenes at Kabul airport. It's not that long ago. It's 2021. Thousands of Afghan people are trying to flee the country because as the US troops were withdrawn from Afghanistan in such a botched effort by President Joe Biden, the Taliban moved in and seized control of the country. And that meant the end of a lot of freedom for people. And obviously the trauma of that, because they'd experienced before, meant people got out of the country as quickly as they could. Mahbuba Faiz was one of the people struggling to get out of Kabul airport back in 2021. She now lives in Ireland and she's live this morning from Cork. Good morning to you, Mahbuba.
Good morning, Oliver. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Not at all. Thank you so much for joining us. I know you've got this great campaign to try and change the lives of the 20 million Afghan women who were left behind there and being erased further and further from public life. But I want to begin, if I can, about your own life story, if that's okay. You spent much of your life, and particularly your early life, as a refugee as well. Isn't that right?
My name is Mahbuba Faiz. I'm a lawyer by profession and a women's rights activist, currently working in RDG solicitor office. I was born and raised in Kabul, Afghanistan. I was born in war and I was raised in war. Wow. I was born in the war against Russian invasion of Afghanistan in the late 1980s.
Yeah.
I was born just a month after my father was killed in the civil war. Mm. My father, who was a government official and was probably looking forward to seeing the birth of his new child, never saw me. I never got to see him. After my father passed away, my mom bore all the burden of family on her own. She had to work very hard, you know, to make ends meet, to put food on the table for four of her orphans. Mm-hmm. She had to basically work in a situation where it was very insecure for women to work. She worked in a completely unstable situation. As we all know, when women are caught in the middle of a conflict, they are more vulnerable to men due to their gender. Mm-hmm. So my mom really found it hard, but still she was able to find a job and work. It was before 1996 when the Taliban came into power.
Their first arrival into power.
Yes, exactly.
So she was able to work as a widow to feed her four children, but once the Taliban came in.
Yeah, so when the Taliban came into power, life for my mom as a widow got worse.
It's illegal to work, essentially, for women, wasn't it?
Yeah, so they banned all women from working, all girls from going to school in 1996, I mean. I would say life for my mom was so tough when she was banned, like millions of other women, from working. She decided to do something, you know, at home and just to find a way to feed us. Mm-hmm. So my mom would normally bake breads at home and she would normally bring it to the market to sell it to make money, obviously. Mm-hmm. I still remember one day when my mom was accompanied by me, so we went to the market. Even though my mom was properly, you know, covered, I mean, by the hijab that the Taliban wanted, but still, yeah, she forgot to put on her socks, and I still remember.
So that was how, the only part uncovered how, was her feet, socks.
Yeah, how they, came to us brutally. How they flogged my mom on her feet because she was not. Because she had to ensure that no strangers could see, you know, her feet or even some parts of her body, her face or her hair.
Extraordinary cruelty, yeah.
I know, yeah, it was so cruel.
So she's beaten for this?
She was beaten just because she was not wearing socks. So from that time, she lost confidence and she decided not to work anymore yeah. outside. So she asked all of our siblings, including me, to go and work. I mean, when I was at the age of 7 or 8, as
really?
A child, I had to work.
Yes.
Not only me, even my older siblings. So I was the youngest at that time.
What are you doing at 7 years of age?
So I normally work in a carpet factory,
really?
In a stone factory where they use kids as a labor, you know, to break the big stones into small stones because they wouldn't have, you know, these modern machines to do that. So they would normally hire kids for a very low payment, you know, to do those
yeah.
stuff. So so myself as a child, I was working
in
that situation.
Your mother, as survival, she ends up marrying, really, doesn't she?
But...
Could you tell us how you end up in Pakistan? Because that's when you first become a refugee.
Yeah, so as I said before, when the Taliban took control of Afghanistan, life for my mom got worse. So eventually she decided to move to Pakistan, one of our neighboring countries.
Yeah.
It was hard for my mom, you know, because we didn't even afford, you know... the travel expenses, but anyway, we finally made it. We traveled by public transportation, and it was I still remember it was the winter time when we left Afghanistan for Pakistan. It took us nearly 15 days, you know, to get to Pakistan.
Yeah.
Well, when we immigrated to Pakistan. The migration exposed us to another, you know, type of suffering.
Nice.
I mean, we had to grapple with poverty, homelessness, lack of education, lack of healthcare resources, everything. But I'm immensely grateful because I was still able to go to school. I was able to finish my high school education there.
So, as difficult as it was in Pakistan, it was much better than being in Afghanistan because you got your education,
at
you learned
least,
English,
at
and
least
so
we,
on.
Yeah. We were able, you know, to go to school and get an education because it was not possible in Afghanistan because the Taliban had banned all girls and women from going to work, schools. So, in Pakistan, despite the challenges and barriers, I got to finish my high school education.
Mm-hmm.
There, I first got enrolled into a school which was run by Pakistani teachers, and because we all didn't have a legal status, so we wouldn't be able, you know, to set the entrance exam or the leaving cert exam. So we had to. All of my siblings, we had to move to another school, which was run by Afghan refugee teachers and for refugees.
Right. Yes.
So this
is where your education comes.
Yeah. So
if we can fast forward to 2007, because thankfully things stabilize. Obviously, people will know the U.S. military infamously invaded Afghanistan in 2001. They defeated the Taliban.
Yeah.
And it's a different country, isn't it, when you return in 2007?
So when we remained as a refugee in Pakistan for nearly a decade, and then when when the Americans, you know, when the U.S. military-led intervened in Afghanistan in 2001 and they overthrown, you know, the Taliban. So the situation in Afghanistan gradually improved. And once again, we had to return, you know, to Afghanistan. We thought, let's go to our own country, like work for our own country. So we moved back to Afghanistan in 2007.
Is life good there?
In Pakistan?
In Afghanistan when you return?
Well, it was better than the first time, you
yes.
know. At least we were all grown up, we were all educated, we knew the language. It was easy for us, you know, to find a job. So all my siblings were able to find a job. And then even myself, even though I was just a high school graduate, I was, because I knew the language, I found a job in a women's rights organization.
As a translator.
Yeah.
And the important thing for you is when you get back to Kabul, you get to follow your dream, don't you? And you do your degree in criminal law.
The dream that I had, you know, I cherished since my childhood, you know, of becoming a lawyer. So a year later, I got married in 2008. Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough, you know, to marry a man who is a women's rights and human rights defender. Mm-hmm.
Imagine that's rare in Afghanistan to have a man supportive of
women's rights. And that's right, because most women in Afghanistan, when they get married, so they won't be allowed, you know, to go to school or universities or pursue their education. So my husband is completely, you know, different to other men
in
Afghanistan. Hassan was so progressive and supportive of my career and education. So he actually encouraged me to go for my higher education. I went to university and did my bachelor's in criminal law, and then I was working for a while when I was expecting my child, so I had to quit my job for a while. And then when my son was at the age of 3, I returned to university for my third level education. I completed my master's in international law. This part is...
Life sounds really good. And yourself and Hassan, you've got a lovely home in Kabul. You're highly educated.
Because we worked tirelessly, especially my husband worked tirelessly, you know, to get me the house that I wanted to have, you know, since my childhood, because I have never had the experience of having a house, because we were always constantly in living, you know.
Yeah. I was reading at the weekend, it's extraordinary. The Americans only had 2,500 troops in the country this time, and that was enough to keep the Taliban at bay.
Well,
but when they announced withdrawal, the country unfortunately collapses.
We had a lot of achievements. We have a lot of, especially in terms of infrastructures, education, healthcare, everything. Like all the people worked so hard for 20 years, and suddenly, you know, everything changed just in a blink of an eye. So there wasn't even a smooth transition. It happened all of a sudden, you know.
Tell us about the time when you have to get to Kabul airport, don't you, get out?
Oh my God, it was so terrifying. On the 15th of August, the day when the country collapsed once again, I was scheduled for my dissertation. I was supposed to go and defend my dissertation. My husband was outside home, and he rang me saying that there's no need to go to university because the city had already fallen to the Taliban, and he asked me to just take a laptop and just our educational documents.
Wow.
And my son, and just leave the house because my husband was a prominent human rights defender, so he really feared for his life and for our lives, you know.
Yeah.
So we had a very beautiful and huge house, So from that huge house, I took only one backpack, just a pair of shoes for my son and clothes, and I locked the door and just left. I took my son and the backpack. We went to relatives. We lived in hiding for a week. So the day when the country collapsed, my husband contacted his colleagues who he was working with before. So fortunately, he was contributing to a project with some Irish colleagues.
Yes, human rights bodies based in Dublin.
So there's an office called Frontline Defenders based in Dublin. And they were kind enough to contact, you know, the Irish government to issue us an online visa. So they really was so kind. They were so kind to us.
Did you have to travel separately to the airport then? Well, I think you were with your son, were you?
It was so hard. It was so terrifying because all the routes to the airport were controlled by the Taliban soldiers. And it was really hard for us, you know, to get to the airport. Anyway, we finally made it. We stayed outside the airport waiting, you know, for the morning to be able, you know, to...
Well, it's terrifying. People will
might remember... Yeah, because thousands of people were you know...
Quite a few people are killed at the airport.
People were rushing.
Including US Marines.
People were panicking. I mean, everybody was just walking around. Nobody knew where to go. But everybody was just going somewhere because... All the people were terrified. They were panicked of the situation of coming back, you know, the Taliban into power. So we, it was so hard, but we finally made it. But it wasn't that easy because there was no direct route, you know, to get into the airport. There was a Suez Canal.
A sewage canal.
Yes, yeah, okay. We had to get into that sewage canal. We had to wait, you know, through that to be able to show our online visas, our documentations that we are at risk. So we asked the soldiers, you know, the American soldiers to help us, you know, to let us get in. So it finally worked. We flew to Doha, Qatar first, and then...
And you're on a military plane, so
aren't
familiar. There are no seats on these.
We were evacuated by the military planes where about, say, 700 to 800 people, all we would, sit on the floor of the plane. There was no seat. Everybody was not allowed to have more than one backpack. We were all sitting, you know, on the floor, just squeezing, you know, each other to make more space. So around I would say 800 people were evacuated in one plane, you know.
What's going through your mind on that flight to Doha?
Well, I was so disappointed, actually. I was so disappointed on the Americans because, they were, you know, the cause for all that terrible situation.
Of course, yeah.
For all those troubles.
The botched withdrawal, which
especially,
Joe Biden ordered.
Especially for my son, who was only 7 years old at that time. It was so hard. His first experience of leaving the country was that way. So I was, but still I was happy because I thought now we will be safe there.
Yes, okay.
Because If we had stayed in Afghanistan, they would have killed my husband and they would have arrested us. So I was still happy to get, you know,
to
the
survive
chance to
family,
survive,
yeah.
to leave the country.
Can I just ask, because we know you had a beautiful life, you had your home, you're highly educated, you had a job, everyone was working. Just because you were in a sewage canal to get onto that plane, how long is it before you get to have a wash?
Well, it is funny. At the same time, it is really sad because we stayed in Doha, Qatar for a week.
Yeah.
And then we moved to Germany. So say after 10 days or nearly 2 weeks, we didn't have, you know, the chance to get a shower when we arrived in Germany. So there was, you know, the chances, you know, to get a shower.
Yeah.
It was so hard. It's
an incredible story. Now, because of the human rights connections that your husband had, mm-hmm. and obviously the fact that this was a war zone, people, the idea of asylum seekers, people forget the reasons they're seeking asylum is because you will be killed if you're sent back to Afghanistan. You're granted asylum
Definitely.
In Ireland. What is your life in Ireland like today?
We were so lucky, you know, to ended up living here in Ireland, in such a peaceful country. I'm so happy for my family, for my son, and I'm so grateful to the Irish government and to the Irish people. They have been so supportive and welcoming so far. Life here, when we first arrived to Ireland, we were initially accommodated in Mosny, County Meath.
Yeah, people will remember a direct provision centre. Yeah.
Direct provision, exactly. We remained there for nearly 3 months, and then we were offered a community house, which was rent-free for 2 years.
Community house for two years?
For 2 years.
Two
it was
years,
rent-free,
rent-free,
but yep. it's not anymore because now we are paying the rent.
Oh, I see.
So,
is that are there many people living there? It's a community house. I'm just not entirely familiar with the term.
So there is actually a group of volunteer people who, compassionate people who are taking refugees in a community and providing them accommodation for say 1 to 2 years. So we were accommodated a house for 2 years, which was rent free.
Because you were granted asylum.
Yeah. And then as of January this year, we have been paying, you know,
that
a rent.
Came to an end.
Yeah.
Okay.
At first it took us a while to get a job. But I was lucky enough, you know, to find a job in RDJ. I was also delighted, you know, to be offered a fee waiver in UCC. Now I'm pursuing my second master's in UCC.
Yeah.
At the same time working in RDJ office. So life is...
It's great. And you're doing another master's in law.
I am, because, you know, my qualifications, I mean, wouldn't qualify me, you know, for
it
a bit.
It doesn't cover the law in Ireland.
Yeah,
yes.
And the legal systems are different.
And I gather when you're staying in Ireland on an asylum visa, if that's the best description, the education is expensive.
We have actually a refugee status here.
Refugee status, maybe.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so as you said, we have to... As a refugee, we won't be able, you know, to do the third level education before living in Ireland for 3 years. Mm-hmm. That's why the UCC, professors and administration was kind enough to me to offer me a fee waiver. So it was a kind of partial scholarship. I just had to pay 25% of the total, you know, fee.
Okay. Yes.
So I got a 75% scholarship, which I'm so grateful to them.
Very good. And RDJ, look after your legal secretary. I better talk to you about the campaign you're now involved in as a lawyer or as someone who's studying law, United Against Gender Apartheid mm-hmm. campaign. Tell us what that is about,
yeah.
Mabuba.
So since the arrival in Ireland, I've always been looking, you know, for the opportunity to speak up about the plight of women in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Because I feel myself so privileged to have the opportunity to exercise all my rights here in Ireland. I have the freedom of choice. I have the freedom of expression, you know, to talk about everything I want. But while millions of women and girls in Afghanistan and even in different parts of the world are deprived of these basic rights.
I want to point out for people, just very quickly, because the Taliban obviously back in power after the age of 8, I think it is, girls are pulled out of education, no college, beauty salons were closed down, access to gyms and parks. And
since
so
seizing power in Afghanistan, the Taliban, since 2021, they have issued more than 50 decrees and orders, which mainly restrict women and girls, you know.
Yeah, not men.
They have, women and girls have been banned from getting an education, going to work, from going to public parks, to gym. They are banned from, you know, running businesses like beauty salons, which left thousands of women, you know, out of jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, they have been deprived of their most basic rights, you know, which women in other parts of the world take it for granted.
And this is why you want this gender apartheid campaign. Where does Ireland stand on this issue?
So actually, there's a group of women's rights activists across globe from Iran and Afghanistan who believe that the way the Taliban are treating women in Iran, in Afghanistan, and the Islamic Republic in Iran are an example, a clear example of gender apartheid.
But we have to get. I'm so sorry we've run out of time, Mahbuba, but it's to get the UN General Assembly, isn't it, to support this? 10 countries on board.
So here,
Ireland not yet, and to get legislators to do.
We are campaigning. We are here three. There is a lecturer from the Galway University. There is Robin Swan, an author and a journalist. The three of us have been campaigning. We are trying to get the support of Ireland, the support of Ministry of Foreign Affairs to support us, you know, support us.
We hear you loud
the term
here.
Gender apartheid
included in international law.
Yeah,
yes, I'm so sorry we've run out of time. We're going to have to take a break. But Mahbuba Faiz, thank you so much for joining us, and the best luck to you and your family. I'm so sorry I had to cut off Mahbuba Faiz there, because we are just out of time, but it is about getting the support of politicians, TDs and women's rights activists involved in her campaign, which you can look up. It is United Against Gender Apartheid. That is the campaign that she's fighting for, Mahbuba and her husband Hassan as well, down in Waterford and in Cork with RDJ. That